Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Center for Advanced Study at the University of Illinois, whose New Biologies Initiative presents The Myth.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Pope John XXIII served as head of the Roman Catholic Church for 5 years, from 1958 until 1963. It was a short tenure, but it launched sweeping reforms for the Church. We'll hear more about the Pope, the history of the Catholic Church, and the reforms of Vatican II in this portion of the program. Our guest is writer and scholar Thomas Cahill. Thomas Cahill is the author of a new book about the man known as the People's Pope. Cahill calls his book, Pope John XXIII, a biographical essay. It is one of the profiles in the Penguin Lives series of books published by Viking. Thomas Cahill is the author of the Hinges of History series, a series of books about pivotal periods in Western civilization. The series includes these titles: How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Gifts of the Jews, and Desire of the Everlasting Hills. A former director of religious publishing at Doubleday, Cahill has served as the North American education correspondent for the Times of London. He has taught at Queen's College, Fordham University, and Seton Hall University. Listeners, I invite your questions for Thomas Cahill. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And for our listeners in the Chicago area, Thomas Cahill will discuss his new book this Wednesday, February 13th, 2002, at 6 p.m. at the Chicago Public Library's Harold Washington Center, which is located at 400 South State Street. The event is free and open to the public. Again, that's Wednesday evening at 6 p.m. at the Harold Washington Center on South State. Thomas Cahill, good afternoon. Welcome.
Celeste, thank you for your invitation.
Oh, you're more than welcome. My pleasure. Would you tell us first a little bit about the Penguin Lives series and how you came to write this book on the man born Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli?
Well, the Penguin Lives series was the brainchild of another writer, James Atlas, who's been a journalist and editor and any number of other things. And he thought that, you know, he himself did a celebrated biography of Saul Bellow, which is, if I may say so, a doorstopper, as are so many biographies. And he thought that many readers would appreciate shorter biographies, in other words, biographical essays, biographies that didn't include everything about the person but gave you a kind of road through the subject's life. And I have to say that Jim Atlas is a very good salesman, and he harassed me for several years until I finally gave in and said, oh, all right, I'll do one of these. But at first, I said to him, no, I'm doing this series, The Hinges of History. It will be 7 volumes when it's finished, if I'm lucky, and it will go through all of Western history, so it will take into account all the peaks that I'd like to discuss, and that's it. But I did come to realize that I wouldn't do an awful lot with the second half of the 20th century, even in the final volume of the series. And so I began to think that there was someone that I would like to write about there, John the 23rd. Of course, to write about him in himself, because he's a wonderful character, mm-hmm. but also because he's the greatest pope of all time. And the truth of the matter is that of the 261 popes that have been, or at least that the Vatican claims, there are very few good ones, let alone great ones. I would say there have only been 2 great ones, John, and then if you go all the way back to the 6th century, you find Gregory the Great, who deserves the title the Great. There have been a handful of good ones, there have been a bunch of mixed ones, and there have been an awful lot of downright bad awful ones. So
yeah.
I felt it was important to put John in the context of papal history, and also because he is such a pivotal figure in the history not only of the papacy and not only of Catholicism, but of Christianity, and really, I think, of world history.
Hmm. The history of the papacy just makes his life seem so remarkable.
I mean, I know.
Head and shoulders remarkable.
Yeah. And I was only giving you a few incidents there. You know, I the first 70 pages of this book or so is devoted to papal history, but as I say, I'm not trying to give history of the papacy. One couldn't possibly do that adequately in 70 pages. What I start off by saying is we wouldn't remember John at all if he hadn't been pope. His last position before he became pope was as Patriarch of Venice, and how many people could name the current Patriarch of Venice or the last one or the one before that? So he really enters history because he became pope, and therefore the platform that he spoke from, namely the papacy, is very important. So my very brief thumbnail history of the papacy is really trying to give the reader an appreciation of how that platform was constructed. And that's how I approach the history.
How did the papacy become a monarchy?
Well, it became a monarchy. You know, everyone is affected by the time in which they live. The early church was really a democracy. In fact, the word church in the original Greek, which was the language of the early church, that word was ecclesia, and it simply means assembly, and it referred to the civic assembly of the people of Athens originally. In other words, it was a town meeting, and that was how the early Christians viewed their organization, such as it was, and the organizational aspects of their organization were extremely rudimentary. They were really just meetings at which people said, "Well, who's going to open the door next week?" Things like that. It wasn't terribly high flying, and there really were the word bishop enters the language of Christianity fairly early. There is a mention of bishops in the New Testament. They're not terribly important, but they're there. They're obviously no different from elders to begin with. It's only in the second century when there were quite a few bizarre heresies in circulation that local Christian churches decided to unite, at least doctrinally, under one leader, whom they began to call a bishop. But that probably doesn't happen in Rome until the middle of the second century. So the idea that Peter was the first pope is really kind of a pleasant fiction, but it doesn't really hold up historically. Peter did come to Rome, and he was martyred there, as was Paul, but neither one of them was what you could have called even a bishop. And then it takes many, many centuries before the Bishop of Rome becomes the Pope. In fact, that word is not used exclusively for him until the 11th century. The word Pope or Papa in Greek and Latin really means father, and it was used as an honorific for bishops and priests in many parts of the Christian world for many centuries before it became exclusively reserved to the Pope. And it's only in the medieval period, when you have the rise of kings as divinely anointed monarchs, that you have the papacy becoming such an institution. And you have popes beginning to assert that they're not only the monarch of their little fiefdom or kingdom, which by then they had acquired, but they're also, in effect, the king of kings. They are in charge of the lesser kings, and this is all a kind of social phenomenon that grows out of the culture of medieval Europe, but it certainly doesn't grow out of ancient theology, and it certainly doesn't grow out of the New Testament.
Mm.
it's a social phenomenon that could that served its purpose for a certain time, and that time is certainly long gone.
You write in the book near the end, once we introduce the gospel as norm, it must be admitted that most popes have been failures.
Well, now, I think that you have to view, when you look at what popes have been up to at various in various stages, the only way to make sense of them is to say, oh, this is just another politician at work.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's doing this or that or the other thing. It has nothing to do with the gospel, which really should be the only norm of judgment for a religious figure within Christianity. These people were not, by and large, truly religious figures. The religious figures of the different ages were usually quite outside the papacy. For instance, the papacy hits one of its strongest periods in the 13th century under Innocent III, who was an extremely worldly man who was interested in looking good and wearing beautiful clothes and increasing his power. He did allow Francis of Assisi to begin the Franciscans. Francis of Assisi was a truly religious figure in the time of Innocent III. It wasn't Innocent III, it was Francis who was the really religious figure who brought people back to an understanding of the gospel and an understanding of Christianity. In fact, Innocent, who thought of himself as kind of all-powerful, had a dream that shook him very much. And in his dream, the papal church of John Lateran, which was the seat of papal power in that period, in his dream, that church was falling down, and it was only being propped up by this little poor man from Assisi, who was, of course, Francis. And with that, Innocent never forgot that dream, and it almost haunted him. And it was really because of that dream that he approved of Francis and let him continue his mission.
Hmm. Now, John he knew the history of the papacy.
Yes, but better than most people. John was a terrific historian, somebody who meditated on history all the time. I mean, he was in fact an academic historian, but he was also, I would say, a creative historian, somebody who was able to look at a particular period and really see elements in it and movements in it that others missed. I think it helped to make him a much better pope than almost any other discipline would have helped to make him.
Mm-hmm. You also mention a couple of things in the book early in his life story that I think are really interesting, and I want you to talk about them a bit, and then we'll go to talk with a listener here who's waiting for us. A couple of things you say are absolutely critical to understanding John when he was growing up and where he came from. The slow-paced, meditative worldview that was possible for a 19th century Italian farm boy, and a sacramental perception of reality, a sacramental orientation.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it was always important to John that he had been born into a poor family. He had great admiration for both his parents, who were extremely responsible, dedicated people, but they had very little. And he felt that poverty had actually formed him to be the man he was. Also, I think beyond that, there was the place that he came from was Northern Lombardy is really a place in which there's such reverence for the natural world and for the processes of nature and of life that you find in the people themselves, and of course you find it expressed perhaps most sharply in the ceremonies of the church, but not simply in the ceremonies of the church. And the people of this area in northern Lombardy really had this a form of spirituality that is called by theologians sacramentality. Now, as a little boy, John didn't know the word, but he had the experience, which is an experience that the world itself, because it's created by a good God, is full of messages for us. It's full of meaning. It's ripe with meaning, and all we have to do is stop and listen in order to hear the messages that God has injected into the natural world for us. It's a very beautiful way of looking at the world, and John carried that all through his life. I think it also kept him very humble, which he always wanted to be. He was a very modest man. He used to make fun of his appearance. He wasn't a beautiful person. He used to make fun. When he became Pope and he noticed himself in a full-length mirror, he said, "Lord, this man is going to be a disaster on television." he was always saying things like that about himself. And when he was Pope, and people were always trying to kneel in front of him, and he was always trying to get them to stand up and sit down next to him. And he would say, "Look, we're both just human beings. We both have two eyes. We both have two ears. We all both have a nose. Of course, my nose is much bigger than yours," because he had quite a large Roman nose. And, he was so easygoing about such things. And his predecessor, Pius XII, whenever he walked in the Vatican Gardens, which are quite beautiful and extensive, insisted that workmen in the gardens hide. They weren't allowed to look at him, and they were to get out of his way. And John didn't understand that at all, because the first time he walked in the gardens, he saw some workmen. He went trudging over toward them, and they ran away. And he said, "What's the matter?" It was explained to him that this was the protocol. And he said, "Well, why shouldn't they look at me? I'm not doing anything scandalous." He had this very down-to-earth view of himself and of other people, so that he was able to meet everyone, high or low, in the same humane manner.
Thomas Cahill, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about Pope John the 23rd. A listener is waiting for us on the toll-free line to talk with us from Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. When you were criticizing the number of corrupt popes, the charges that many of the Protestant reformers, such as Calvin and Luther and Zwingli, Knox, made against the papacy, would you say that, recognizing its generalizations are maybe quite somewhat difficult, but the critique or criticisms they made of the papacy were accurate?
Yes, I would say they were. And I think it's time that Catholics admitted that. As a Catholic, I feel very comfortable saying that. Mm-hmm. A large part of what the Second Vatican Council did, the council that was called by John, was in effect to admit that the reformers had been right about a great many things, especially in the period of the Renaissance Reformation, not only the papacy but the clergy in general and the religious orders were in dire need of reformation. Some of that reformation occurred at the Council of Trent, which was a kind of anti-Protestant council, a kind of reactionary council. Finally, at the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s, the Church, in effect, admitted that, to a large degree, the reformers had been right, even from a Catholic point of view.
Could I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
I realize, again, it's hard to jump to conclusions. Sometimes the questions you ask may reflect a bias, but, in the Boston area, this horrible scandal about Catholic priests molesting kids. I realize that's a spectrum, a small... Would you say that one could make any criticisms of the priest today, recognizing that, all group have their skullduggery, that would come anywhere near to the Reformation era?
I'm not even sure that... I think you're being more gentle than you need to be. And I don't think that Boston is... What's happening in Boston is an oddity. I think that as many of these pedophilia scandals emerged in the late 80s and early 90s and are now emerging again in Boston, they will continue to emerge in different places in the country and throughout the world. There's been a real shift in consciousness, certainly in the Western world, but I think far beyond the Western world, and it's a shift that has to do with sexuality. If you go back to the 1930s, the men who were being ordained, who are now either old, very old, retired, or dead, you find priests who were not really that unlike say, the Bing Crosby figure in Going My Way, you know, relatively down-to-earth, good-natured, humane, expansive people who were willing to sacrifice their sexuality to a cause. The world is much more sexualized now than it was in that period, and people are no longer willing to do that. Men are no longer willing to sacrifice their sexuality for a lifetime. Very few of them, anyway. And because of that, and I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, the sexualization. I think that it's better than the world that I grew up in, where nobody talked about such things. There are bad things about it, but I think in general it's a healthy step forward. And I would say that, and this is not my own opinion so much as the general consensus of those who have taken a good look at it, the men who are going into seminaries now are not of the Bing Crosby Going My Way type in any sense. They tend to be sexually infantile and narcissistic. It's not merely that they tend toward, that their orientation is tends to be homosexual, which is not a surprise at all, but that they actually don't look at other human beings, say young children, as independent human beings. They look on them as aspects of themselves, which is what infantile, narcissistic people always do. And this is going to continue to create great problems for the Catholic Church until the Church recognizes that what has to be dealt with is the universal imposition of celibacy on the higher clergy. I think that there's no way of that not unraveling if we are to solve this problem. And if we don't solve the problem, the Church in North America certainly is just going to implode on itself. It could finally result in an enormous leave-taking on the part of lay people, or a schism. I'm afraid that bishops are simply using the kind of ostrich method of keeping their heads in the sand and not recognizing the severity and crucial nature of the moment that they're living in. Mm.
There was a poll taken in Boston of Catholics, and almost half said that the cardinal should step down. I'm wondering, this to me says that people think there's a serious problem, and I'm wondering, does Rome see it?
Well, as ostrich-like as the American bishops may be, Rome is even
more so.
Yeah. I would say that Rome has their head not in the sand, but up some part of their anatomy at this point. They really are just not recognizing what's going on at all, and are probably contributing to a worsening of the situation here. But again, one of the reasons that this is happening is because we are so open about sexuality, and people are now willing to come forward and say, you know, this was done to me when I was a child, and I'm sick of thinking about it. And it's time that I opened up my mouth and spoke about it. There are other parts in the world where people still would not be willing to do that, just as, say, in this country, they wouldn't have been willing to do it in the 19th century or in even the early part of the 20th century. So we've got a lot going on here that is actually very, very positive, if it were looked at in a certain way. It's an opportunity for the Church to react appropriately and to reform itself.
Back to John, and, you know, he's been dead since 1963. I'm wondering, how does the Church view his accomplishments, view his tenure as Pope today? And by the Church, I mean the Vatican, the folks in Rome, I guess.
Okay, I don't mean that, by the way.
I know.
By the Church, I mean the people.
It's clear what the people think of him, I think.
The people think very highly of John.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's very interesting that he was in the crypt of the popes underneath the high altar of St. Peter's. There are many, many popes buried there, and their tombs are of course, swept and cleaned every day, and they look great. But there's nobody in front of those tombs, whereas John has always had an enormous crowd of people praying in front of his tomb, so much so that they finally moved his body into the main body of the basilica to accommodate the crowds. And the Catholic people, and I would say that the Christian people and even the people of the world long ago decided that John was a saint. They don't require the official approbation of the Vatican. But with regard to what does the Vatican think of him, well, they have, the current pope has beatified him. Unfortunately, at the same time that he beatified John the 23rd, he beatified Pius the 9th, who was probably one of the four or five worst popes in history, a man who actually kidnapped a Jewish child and refused to give him back to his parents. He's the pope who insisted on being called infallible. He's the pope who lost the papal states and cursed the new secular government of a united Italy and told Catholics they could have nothing to do with it. He's an entirely reactionary. He's your original mean old man. The fact that John Paul II beatified him, a man nobody wanted to see beatified, is an indication that what he hopes to pull off with these beatifications is to suggest that both the right and the left have something to say. In this case, in the case of Pius IX, the right has absolutely nothing to say at all. They have no ground to stand on. And it's an extremely high-handed, frivolous thing that John Paul II did by this beatification of Pius IX, who was called, by the way, by the Italians Pio Nono, because the only words he regularly said were no-no. Mm.
The abominable no-pope.
Right.
Let's talk with another listener. On the toll-free line, a caller in Chicago. Hi.
Yes, thank you for a very informative program. I certainly look forward to reading your book. I was going to introduce something that I never thought I'd have to ask. It's about corporate matters. I recall 20, 30 years ago, somewhere along the line, the Vatican's wealth was in the hands of some particular individuals within the structure for speculation, and that overnight, I think it was in the area of currency, they speculated and lost 10% of the value of all the wealth of the Vatican. Do you recall that?
Yeah, it was sort of an earlier Enron, huh?
Well, I was wondering.
These things happen. The Vatican does invest its money, which should be no surprise to anybody. And sometimes they win and sometimes they lose, the way all investors do. I think that they are now probably in wiser hands than they were during particular crisis, but I wouldn't absolutely count on that. Because of the secrecy in how the Vatican, what kind of wealth the Vatican has and how it spends it.
It almost applies to the current people in the, that they're investigating in Congress also, as well as the...
Yeah, but nobody's going to investigate this. And a lot of the Vatican secrecy is just a form of stupidity. They would be so much better off if they admitted what was going on, if they were more transparent. And it's a kind of knee-jerk reaction, and it's not even politically smart. Quite aside from it being evangelically smart, they don't have nearly as much to hide as one might suppose, given all the secrecy.
Well, hope we can learn from each other. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we go to a listener on line one in Champaign County. Hi.
Hi there. Let's see. I wanted to make a little preface, which is that the two nuns, one in grade school and one in high school, that I had contact with that were most enthusiastic about John 23, both left, you know, and this was much before John Paul II. This was in the interim period, and I don't even remember the Pope's names at this point.
The Pope would have been Paul the VI.
Yeah. So they were already feeling like the metaphor that the grade school nun used was, let's throw open the windows to the stuffy old church. And,
well, John, that was John's own metaphor.
Well, she literally did it, and then I guess she was illustrating the metaphor. But So she was excited about it, but she left after 3 or 4 years after that, before I got to high school. The one in high school left. Anyway, that was just a preface. I'm an avalanche Catholic, which is one step past fallen, I guess you say.
What kind of Catholic?
Avalanched.
Yeah. Avalanched.
Okay. Yeah. All right. But you said that nobody wanted Pio Nono, and that's, you know, that's not true. It's Opus Dei, and it's the right wing. I think you actually said something saying that it was a sop to the right. But apparently, you know, he's...
Well, actually, I'm not sure that Opus Dei was interested in the... well, maybe they were. I mean, possibly. But I should have said virtually no one. I mean, there's the deposed members of the old right-wing Italian nobility wanted him beatified, and there's a pizzeria in Rome called Il Papa Re, which means the Pope King, and that's a reference to Pio Nono, so presumably the people who own that pizzeria wanted him beatified. I mean, there are a few, but these are really not, the church as a whole is embarrassed by this beatification.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is that there are the Opus Dei types in the right wing, and incredible that, you know, I think what he was thinking was you can't put up John 23, who is controversial in these latter small circles, without doing something for them, basically. It was an even-handed thing, and it shows you how far to the right even-handed is, I guess, in the Catholic Church.
At least
Church
under
of Rome.
The Pope, yeah.
Yeah, Innocent III, as we were talking about earlier, isn't it one Innocent after him, Innocent IV, that was one of the most flagrant despots? But I guess since that's the it's sort of like the kings, they don't all go in order.
The worst despot of all is probably Boniface VIII, but there are so many of them that... It's hard to pick and choose among them.
Yeah.
As far as that goes, you know, the absolute the theory of absolute monarchy was at its peak at the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance, and that's when you get some of the worst, the most flagrant power moves that should never have occurred.
Mm. The caller brings up an interesting point, which I think is that struck me reading your brief history of the papacy, was that the church has had so many inquisitions and inquisition-like periods during its history. I mean, if you just look at the time when John is a boy and a young man growing up, well, Leo the 13th was on the papal throne, and John thought highly of him. Mm-hmm. However, then comes Pius the Ninth.
No, Pius the Tenth.
Pius the Tenth.
Pius the Ninth was dead by the time
John
the 23rd was born.
Okay, so we got
Pius. That's all right. You're allowed to get them mixed up.
Okay, Pius the Ninth, Leo the 13th, then comes along
Pius the Tenth.
Pius the Tenth, who was another...
he's a real horror, to tell the truth. And, of course, he's been canonized as well. I mean, he said he was the church's own Joe McCarthy. You know, he set off a reign of terror in the church, and so many theologians were condemned, and priests and bishops made to leave the ministry. It was a terrible time.
And even when John is a priest, he's a father, he's told to be careful, he's told to watch it,
mm-hmm.
what he's teaching.
Yep. He is indeed. He was accused of modernism, which was the thing that it was really a heresy that Pius X dreamed up. It didn't really exist. I don't even know what he was talking about. There's no way of outlining what he meant when he talked about modernism, except it meant being modern, really. He was against that, I suppose. But it was a heresy that existed in his own head and nowhere else. And these terrible moments in the history of the church are not the whole church, and they never were. It's one of the problems with concentrating on the papacy is that you end up leaving out people like Francis of Assisi, whom I mentioned earlier. You leave out all the best, most wonderful things. That's why it was such, in the book, it's such a great moment when I finally get past the history of the papacy and we get to the Roncalli family, the family that John came from, and you begin to get a sense of Catholicism as a whole, which is much more hopeful than the history of the popes taken alone.
Yeah, the church in, as John is growing up in his world, the church is a living, breathing thing. It's in the community. It's up the street.
Yes, and it saved people like the Roncalli family. You know, Catholic Action, which was born in the same area that John came from, and which set up credit banks for ordinary people, really, they were the ones who finally enabled the Roncalli parents to buy their farm from its medieval masters, so that they were no longer sharecroppers but owners. So there were, you know, there are many, many movements within the church that have nothing whatever to do with the papacy, or very little to do with the papacy, and those are the ones that usually end up being far more important. It's not unlike society as a whole. In the time of John Kennedy, the most important American was no doubt Martin Luther King, who had no official position, but he brought society to a new point. The same kind of thing happens within the church.
It's interesting to me, during the war years, John goes to Bulgaria, Istanbul. It seems that this was a very important time for him, and that these assignments, these posts, were very important.
Yeah, I think so too. Even though they looked like he was being sent off to into exile, mm-hmm. to the ends of the earth, in those places he met Orthodox Christians and John became friends with virtually anybody he met. So he had many Orthodox friends. He had many Muslim friends, and of course, when he was in Istanbul, he was instrumental in saving the lives of many, many Jews who were fleeing the Third Reich, and for whom the only last escape route was from Eastern Europe through Istanbul to Palestine, then under British mandate. I estimate that John probably saved about 100,000 Jews very, very quietly. He kept bothering officials in all these countries until he could get from them what he wanted, and helped spring people out of these places and get them on their way to Palestine. And of course, many of them at the end of the war remembered him only too well. Then when he got to Paris, he unexpectedly became the papal nuncio or ambassador to Paris at the end of the war. He then broadened his circle of contacts even more and became great friends with Protestants, communists, secularists, socialists, atheists, and by the time he became pope, he really, I think, understood much more about the modern world and certainly was completely unafraid of it.
How was it that he became pope?
Isn't that an interesting question? And, you know, did people know who he was? Did they make a mistake? Well, I don't think they made a mistake, but they didn't expect from him what they got. The people who voted for him were really a kind of, within the conclave of cardinals, were a combination of Italians and Frenchmen. The Frenchmen, I think, very much knew who they were voting for because they had known him when he was in Paris. And certainly Cardinal Feltin, who was the Archbishop of Paris, understood that Roncalli, the man who would become John the 23rd, was not simply an affable, genial old man, which is what many people took him to be. But probably some of the people who voted for him thought that that was all there was to it. It's a little hard to know exactly, but they voted for an old man because they wanted a short papacy, sort of for everybody to get their breath and decide what would happen next. Well, it was the Pope who decided what would happen next by throwing open the church to this council, which he allowed to remain completely free and make all of its own decisions. And it wasn't a question of implementing his program. It was a question of they're deciding what they thought they should say to the church and to the world. He really wanted this body of deliberation to be free to make its own choices, which was a great thing to do.
But it wasn't easy, even as he was pope, to call an ecumenical council was very difficult. He stood up and talked before the cardinals, and he had to lull them into kind of a sleepy stage, and then he let them have the news, and later, what he'd said, his message, it turns out that somebody edited it.
Yes. Well, there was a lot of that, and he did have to work against the Vatican bureaucracy. He really was forced to be very, very clever, and he was very clever, as it turns out, and he managed to overcome them. It's also unfortunate that the Pope who followed him, Paul VI, took away some of the freedom of the Council. He did keep the Council in session until 65, when it all ended, and they made their, they issued the documents of the Council. But he did take two extremely important issues away from the Council. One was clerical celibacy, and the other was birth control. Had he left those with the Council would have decided very differently from the way that Paul VI decided, which is exactly why he took those issues away from them. In doing that, he did something that John would never have done, and I think it was the beginning of the bad steps that have got us to the place where we are today, which was commented on by an earlier listener about the scandal in Boston, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Why would John have trusted?
John really, he believed, he was a deep believer, and he believed in the Holy Spirit. He believed that the Holy Spirit was there and would guide the assembly, and that he didn't really have to be in charge of anything. He just had to let them take off. He believed in human freedom. He was a true Democrat, and a Democrat within the church. He was not in favor of controlling anything. Even at the council itself, he very slyly said to the Protestant and Orthodox representatives whom he had invited to the council to be part of it, I don't claim any special inspiration. I just told to that the Holy Spirit takes care of things. And was this a kind of sly renunciation of papal infallibility? Of course it was, but he could only bring his own church so far in that short period of time. It's really, I think, up to the church as a whole to continue along that path.
Mm. What do you think lies ahead near term for the church?
I don't know. I always say that we don't know what's going to happen 10 minutes from now, let alone a year or 10 years from now. With regard to the official church, the church of the bishops, a large part will depend on how much longer John Paul II lasts and who is elected to follow him. But it's important to remember that you can't really understand the church and what's going on in it if you only watch the papacy. It's possible that a new pope will change direction very much. It's possible that a new pope will attempt to take the church even farther to the right. I think if that were to happen, we would have enormous rending of, certainly of the American church, but I think many other national churches would find it simply impossible to put up with that, and would lay people will either leave or create a schism if it were to go in that direction.
New church or avalanche, huh?
I think so. Of course, what's happened over the last several years is that people have quietly more and more slipped away. If you go into especially urban Catholic churches, you pretty much, it's easy to count the non-white heads. Young people are not sticking with it by and large, and there's very good reason for that.
What kind of reaction is the book getting from Catholics?
I don't know. It's only out a couple of weeks, so it's a little hard to judge that. There have been very few reviews, none in Catholic publications.
Really?
I have, in my talks, I've gotten very positive reactions. I presume that certainly many of the people in each audience would be Catholic, though perhaps not a majority, or certainly not all of them. The majority of American Catholics would stand with John the 23rd. So it's not surprising to find them open to this book.
Thomas Cahill, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Celeste.
Our guest this afternoon, Thomas Cahill. He is the author of a new book about the man known as the People's Pope, Pope John the 23rd. He calls the book a biographical essay. It is one of the profiles in the Penguin Lives series of books published by Viking. He's also the author of the Hinges of History series, a series of books about pivotal periods in Western civilization. These books include How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Gifts of the Jews, and Desire of the Everlasting Hills.